For this month's Ask an Astronomer, we are joined by Dr. Ian McDonald, who's joined us many times before in the past, and is actually my academic supervisor, so I have to be very nice to him today. As always, we have three listener-submitted questions. The first one is from Penny. We recently watched The Martian and were generally impressed by the physics accuracy compared to a lot of movies, but one thing stood out as potentially impossible. So I should probably stop listening now if you particularly bother about spoilers from this film. But right at the end, when Matt Damon is trying to get to the spaceship, he gets to it by puncturing his spacesuit and using the jet of air to propel him to his colleagues. Wouldn't the altitude change need a lot more energy than you would get from a small jet of air to raise him to a high orbit and meet the commander?
I liked this question. It gave me an excuse to watch YouTube at work. During this very detailed research, I found that, in the movie, the velocity difference between Matt Damon and the spaceship that he's trying to get to is about 11 metres per second, or about 25 miles an hour. And that's about the speed that you get from jumping out a third-story window, so it's already not looking terribly good from a physics point of view. It's also this 11 metres per second that determines whether he can get there or not. And it's just a case of working out whether he's got the energy from the escaping gas, and whether that's greater than the energy that he needs to get to this speed. And anyone who's done high school physics probably has hazy memories of E equals half mv squared. Now, surprisingly, googling the mass of Matt Damon didn't return any useful results. So, we'll assume that he weighs about 70 kilos. Now, modern spacesuits weigh anything from 10 kilos to 178 kilos, depending on their intended use. The ones that are used in the film seem quite lightweight, so let's go with about 30 kilos for the mass of the spacesuit. And that's 100 kilos for the mass of the spacesuit, plus the esteemed Mr. Damon. And half mv squared then tells us that he needs 6,050 joules of energy to get him up to the right speed. So how much energy can he get from the air that he's carrying? Well, that mainly depends on the amount of air that he has. The air will come out of the puncture at about the speed of sound, but most extravehicular spacesuits use reduced pressures. So I reckon that he might get about maybe 26 joules for every litre of air that he loses. And using this conversion, Matt probably needs about 230 litres of air to get him up to the right velocity. Now, NASA astronauts typically carry a few hundred litres of air with them during spacewalks, but the suits they use tend to be a lot more bulky than the one he's wearing in the film, because of the need to store this extra oxygen. So, Matt Damon probably could make it, but only if he has a lightweight suit and heavily pressured oxygen tanks. Otherwise, he's probably a little bit doomed. So my verdict? Well, it might work, but I wouldn't want to bet my life on it.
Thank you, Ian. I'm always impressed with the amount of questions we get in that can be resolved using, you know, high school or A-level physics. It's really impressive. Our next question comes from Mark Weaver. The great red spot on Jupiter would seem to be shrinking. How well understood is this? At its current rate of decline, how long would it take before it disappeared?
Well, Jupiter's great red spot is a hurricane-like storm, and it's been present on Jupiter for at least two centuries. In the last 100 years, it's shrunk to about half of its previous size, so it's conceivable that it might disappear within the next 100 years or so. Or it might grow again and persist for longer. We don't really know. Like on Earth, storms on giant planets tend to be fairly transient features, and they form and decay. Saturn has a long-lasting hexagonal spot in one pole. The storm on the planet in 2011 encircled the entire planet over a few months. While Uranus showed a very bland disk when Voyager flew past it, more recent Hubble Space Telescope images show bright and dark spots on the planet, and these change over months and years. Neptune famously showed a dark blue spot when Voyager passed it, but Hubble has failed to image it again, and so that's probably a fairly short-lived storm. So in our solar system, Jupiter seems fairly unique in having long-lived storms. And what makes storms in Jupiter especially noticeable are the strong colour changes that occur in the planet's upper atmosphere, which gives great contrast to these storms. And this, and the relatively large size of Jupiter seen from Earth, make it easy to track these storms, and they have been tracked since the discovery of the telescope. Now, the longevity of Jupiter storms is, at least partially, down to its rapid rotation. A day on Jupiter lasts less than 10 hours, and the different latitudes rotate at very different rates. And this differential rotation allows shear forces to build up and create storms, a bit like permanent whirlpools can form on Earth when currents interact. Now, there's many storms in Jupiter, but the Great Red Spot is by far the biggest, and it seems to get its energy from cannibalising the little storms, so it should persist as long as it can find a ready diet of storms to eat. In May 2008, a little red spot formed on Jupiter, but it was only a few months later that it was cannibalised by the Great Red Spot. Another feature, called Oval BA, turned red in 2005, and it's now a sizeable fraction of the Great Red Spot's size. The two storms pass each other every couple of years, and so far Oval BA hasn't been eaten, but it might only be a matter of time. If it does get swallowed by the Great Red Spot, that could extend the Great Red Spot's lifetime significantly. Now, weather predictions are quite hard on Earth, where we basically understand what's going on, so I think it's safe to say that we don't really know what the future of the Great Red Spot is, but it'll probably be quite fun finding out.
So I suppose a good follow-up question here is, do you expect Juno to help us understand these features more?
Well, Juno's going to do a lot of imaging of Jupiter's surface while it's there, and that's going to give us quite unprecedented detail of the storms that are going on Jupiter. And so that, combined with ground-based and space-based imagery from Earth, will tell us a lot more about how these storms form and interact.
Okay, thank you. So the final question here is really Ian's specialty, and comes from Charles. My question concerns the transformation of our Sun into a red giant. What will happen to the Earth-Moon system?
Well, I've been looking at the last phases of stellar evolution, particularly the evolution of Sun-like stars, for the last 10 years. So I'm in a good position to tell you exactly how much we don't know about what's going to happen. What we do know is that in about 7.5 billion years' time, the Sun will run out of nuclear fuel. And as it burns the last of this fuel, it will increase in size by a factor of maybe 100 to 200 times, before becoming a planetary nebula and fading away as a white dwarf. And we know that during this process, the expanding Sun will engulf Mercury and Venus, and they'll likely be destroyed. Mars and the outer planets will probably survive, and they'll probably remain in orbit around the dead Sun, unless their orbits interact with each other and one gets thrown out. But the Earth is just on the boundary between these two zones, and we don't know whether it will be engulfed, or whether it will survive to orbit to the dead Sun. For the Earth's future, there are two competing forces that will determine our fate. Firstly, we've got tidal drag, and that pulls us towards the Sun. And secondly, we've got the solar wind, and that reduces the Sun's mass, and makes the Earth's orbit expand further away from the Sun. Now, we don't have enough information to work out which of these effects will win. The strength of the solar wind in particular is very crucial to this factor, and it sets the maximum size and lifetime of the Sun. If we do manage to escape destruction by the Sun, the Earth and the Moon will look very different. They will still be recognisable as the Earth-Moon system. Although the Earth and Moon are moving further apart because of the tides create, they do so quite slowly. And over recent geological time, the Moon has been moving 22 kilometres away from the Earth every million years. And as it does so, it takes energy from the Earth's spin. So our day gets longer by about 12 seconds every million years. But this evolution will only continue as long as the Earth has oceans, which are what provides the tidal damping force. And the oceans are predicted to boil off the Earth in about 1 or 2 billion years' time, as the Sun gets hotter. So the Earth and the Moon will still be recognisable as they are today, although our day will be a few hours longer, and the Moon will be fractionally further away. Although the physical Earth may survive, it will probably undergo a runaway greenhouse effect, like Venus has today, except more severe. And this could heat up the surface of the Earth to over 1,000 degrees Celsius, turning the Earth's surface into a magma ocean and erasing the surface of the Earth we see at present. So there'll be nothing for future civilizations to find of us, except the probes that we've sent out into the outer solar system. The picture will be even more dismal if we're pulled the other way, into the Sun. The first thing that will happen is that heat from the Sun will transform the Earth and the Moon into balls of liquid rock. And once the Earth and the Moon are enveloped by the Sun's outermost atmospheric layers, drag forces will gradually force the Moon to spiral in towards the Earth. Now, since the Moon and the Earth are going to be balls of magma at this point, the collision of the Moon into the Earth will be a fairly sedate process, although you might want to stick around for the magma tsunami, which will be pretty spectacular. And once the Earth-Moon conglomerate has been absorbed by the Sun, the magma oceans will probably boil away into nothing as it's dragged further into the Sun's atmosphere. However, it's not certain that it would be completely destroyed. The outer regions of the red giant Sun will be very tenuous, and we're now finding the ghosts of planets around white dwarf stars that we think were one time orbiting inside the red giant stars that they came from. And it may be that the Earth will still rise, phoenix-like, out of the dying Sun, and orbit the cooling white dwarf Sun as a rocky cinder until the end of time. Either way, that's a pretty dismal end to the Earth's history.
But on a positive note, at least for a while, Manchester will be quite a dry place for once, so you got that to look forward to.
That's certainly going to improve the climate around here.
Thank you very much, Ian.